occurring throughout the world in a variety of topics, from the latest trends on the internet to current developments in neuroeconomics to the future of design in an energy-conscious world. Please make Mark very welcome to the Bond Conference. Thank you, Mark.
Just a couple of seconds while we change over all of the computers. Just a little, it's not quite. All right. I was going to use the palm mic, but if we all want to keep our hearing, I'm not going to use it. Good morning. Now, I recently had the opportunity to teach a class at the University of Sydney. I have an honorary position there, which means they get to invite me in a few times a year and they don't have to pay me. Very interesting job. But that doesn't mean I don't get to use the time wisely. I generally consider teaching as a two-way street. If I'm doing my job well, then I'm open to learn as much from my students as I'm trying to teach them. Sometimes all I have to do is simply watch what they're doing, what new behaviors are they showing me, and I can take a look at those and then extrapolate around the kinds of behaviors that are spreading across the culture. Other times, I take advantage of a captive audience to run an ethnographic survey. And so on this day, I think it was the 2nd of August, I had 80 eager students, and I asked them a couple of questions about mobile usage patterns within their age group. So the first thing I asked them was how old they are. So we got that. Of course, it mostly clusters around 19 to 20 because it's about the second year of university when they take this class. And the second thing I then asked them was, how old were you when you first had a mobile phone of your own? There's the chart, and it clusters along around 11, 12, and 13. And when you add up the data, you actually find that half of the students owned a mobile phone at around age 11 and a half. I compiled the data when I got back home and tweeted the results. And some folks said, you know, that sounds a little bit old, actually. And of course, it does sound a little bit old because I'm asking 20-year-olds when they got a phone, and they're saying, oh, it was 8 years ago. So we're actually looking back to 2003, which is the year that I arrived in Australia. That isn't the present moment. If you want the present moment, we go to another survey whose results were published last month. Shows you how much has changed so quickly. 37%, this is in America, of children between kindergarten and year two have a mobile phone of some sort. 20% of them have smartphones. By year eight, the figure is 85%. One-third of them are using smartphones. Now, since the mobile was introduced, which was 30 years ago this month, the average age of first ownership has dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. For a long time, the device was simply too expensive to give to a child. Now, you can go and buy an Android smartphone on an Optus network, I think, for about $100. You can spend $20, $25 a month on carrier fees. So that within the exception of the poorest Australians, price is no longer a barrier to mobile ownership. And so, as the price barrier has dropped, the first age of mobile ownership has dropped and dropped. It was 11 years old in 2003, somewhere between 8 and 9 years old today. And there's a resistance to mobile ownership in the sub-8-year-old crowd. But that's being overcome as we design the devices to be more compatible with children with less developed cognitive skills. Because when you get below age 8, the mobile morphs. It's no longer this general purpose communications device. It's now a tether between the parent and the child, which allows each to remain in constant connection with the other. Now, only a few mobiles have been designed so far for the needs of young children. The market hasn't really been ready enough, mature enough, to handle a whole bunch of child-friendly devices. And the carriers haven't developed plans that make it inexpensive for a parent to give a child a mobile, because let's face it, the child's not going to be sending a lot of text messages. They're just basically going to be calling mom. And as the carriers figure this out, and as the manufacturers develop headsets, then mobile ownership in the age group under 8 years old is going to continuously become a more attractive option. And that's inevitably going to happen because more and more and more of us are using mobile phones. The day when that happens is not very far away, because what we're doing is we're designing away the resistance to mobile ownership among sub-8-year-olds. And there's no real end to that in sight. When you move to a younger and younger child, the less it becomes a communications platform and the more the mobile becomes a benevolent watcher that is continuously reporting the condition of the child to the parent. Now, if you think about it, when we have infants, we put a little radio transmitter in their bedroom so that we can hear them fussing in their cots and we can wander around the rest of the house. We don't think anything about that. Well, that's exactly what's going to be happening to the mobile phone, only it's going to be even smarter. It's going to track the child's heartbeat, it's going to track their temperature and the other vital statistics, and it's going to grow smaller, it's going to grow less power hungry until, I promise you this, sometime in the next 15 years, a child is going to receive their first mobile when they pop out of the womb because it's going to be embedded in the tag and get stuck over their leg. That ID tag is going to have a mobile phone in it. And so, it's an absolute inevitability that every single child entering every single school everywhere in Australia will be coming with their own mobile in hand. They're just going to join the rest of us because we are. And that means they're going to be directly and immediately connected to everyone who's important to them. And why should Australian children be any different than the rest of us? Do you know what the mobile subscription rate is in Australia right now? Someone call out a figure. What percentage of Australians have mobile subscriptions?
95.
Close. I mean, I'm sitting here guilty because I've got an iPad and I've got an iPhone and they both have mobile subscriptions and I actually just bought this other nifty little thing which is a 3G to Wi-Fi bridge so I can have Wi-Fi wherever I go. So I've got 3 subscriptions just for myself. A lot of people have separate mobiles for home and for work. People have, it's multiplying. So 120 is just a baseline. It's only going up from here. And so there's one more than one per person, and that doesn't even count all the people who are either too old or too young right now to use mobile phones. So mark my words, within a generation, being a human and being connected will be synonymous. So we're in this middle time now. This is maybe a 10 or 15 year period. Between the time when none of us were connected and the time when being connected is just assumed. And this is the time, it's this precise moment when we have to do the pedagogical and institutional adjustments that will help us to accommodate what it means to be inside of a pervasively connected culture. Now that survey that I talked about from last year, it showed that even at the kindergarten level, parents were overwhelmingly willing to buy a mobile for their child if schools integrated the mobile into pedagogy. But the survey also showed something very interesting, and I'll quote directly from it. When we asked administrators about the likelihood of them allowing students to use their own mobile devices for instructional purposes at school this year, a resounding 65% of principals said, no way. So school principals overwhelmingly hold this comforting belief that the transition into the pervasively connected culture can be prevented or forestalled or simply banned. You know, a decade ago, most schools banned mobiles entirely. Now, 2011, okay, they're allowed, but they're allowed within very specific restricted situations. A few years from now, there is going to be no way to silence the mobile because so much of what the student is doing will be contingent on having that constant connectivity. So, like King Canute, we are not going to be able to hold back the tide here. We have to prepare now for the rising waters because we're going to have to learn how to swim inside the sea of connectivity or otherwise we are going to be drowned by it. Now, when people connect together, the thing that they do automatically, without being told to do it, is they share. It's an expression of an instinctive human desire that we have to communicate matters of importance to one another. If you give someone an open channel, they will transmit everything they can think of that might possibly be interesting to anyone. And at the beginning, when we first get connected, that can look very unfocused. It can be bad jokes, it can be cute kittens. As time passes, we teach one another the things that we find interesting, the things that we consider important enough to share because we're sharing them. So sharing, driven by need and amplified by technology, reaches every one of us. It reaches us through the networks of our connections. And we both give and receive. We give from what we know and we receive according to what we want to learn. That's the key component. And sharing has amplified our scope of awareness. We can easily find and connect to other people who share our interests, which then immediately increases our awareness of those interests. Now, the parent-child bond is the most essential of all human interests. And that means that right now, parents are loading kids up with the technologies of connection, and they are gaining a kind of situational awareness in their children's lives, which would make them the envy of ASIO. The mobile becomes the eyes and ears and capability at a distance. It's the lifeline, it's the surrogate. The child uses the mobile to share experiences, both actively and passively. And the parent, wherever they may be in the world, hovers, watching, guiding. It's called helicopter parenting. And it was extremely difficult to put into practice before we were all connected together because of that kind of vigilance required presence. Well, the mobile has cut that particular cord. And so it allows parental hypervigilance to become a persistent feature of the educational environment. And so, as the techniques for this electronic hypervigilance become less expensive, as they become easier to use, they will become the accepted practice for child raising. Now, this is Genevieve Bell. She's an amazing woman. She's a friend of mine, Australian. But she is the lead anthropologist for Intel Corporation. So she mostly works out of Santa Clara. She goes around the world and talks to people who are using technology. And she told me about a day she spent in a South Korean classroom. And in this classroom, lots of kids had mobiles that had GPS tracking capability built in so that the parents of these children knew where these kids were every single minute. And Dr. Bell asked the children, how do you feel about this, thinking that the children would go, yeah, it's kind of creepy, but what do you got to do? In fact, what the children said was they pointed to another child in the classroom who didn't have one of these fancy mobile phones. They said, her parents don't care where she is. So in the context of the parent-child bond, something that would look completely Orwellian to us is transformed into the ultimate security blanket. Now, I have a friend who has a child in kindergarten in Sydney. He's a very precocious boy, and he finds the classroom environment as a result both boring and confronting alternately. And so my friend's being constantly called in to speak to the teacher. He's being disruptive. He links this disruptive behavior to the fact that he's being bullied, but the teacher doesn't see the bullying going on, so the teacher doesn't do anything about it. The boy's getting more and more frustrated. We were talking about this, and I was thinking, gosh, how could that change? And I thought, now imagine that before he leaves for school in the morning, his mom affixes a small button to his school uniform. Maybe it's on the collar, maybe it's on the shirt pocket. And the button has a camera, a microphone, and a mobile transmitter built into it. And that means that the child is continuously live streaming everything that's going on around him from his collar to mom's mobile all day long. And the child wouldn't have to set it up, wouldn't have to do anything at all. It would simply work. And that means that my friend would have eyes and ears wherever her son went. And if there was trouble, if there was bullying or anything else that demanded attention, my friend could simply take that section of video and mail it off to the school teacher. And this is not science fiction, people. It's not even far away. When I left the house yesterday, I spent a couple of minutes setting up a Skype account on a laptop that's sitting at home. And there, that's my office right there. Right? We're just looking in on it. Thank goodness there's no one in there. All right. But all I had to do was press a button. This capability is base standard on every smartphone. We already have this capability. It's just a matter of making it a little bit smaller and a little bit more battery efficient. But we can all put our eyes and ears everywhere, and you could, if you were sufficiently concerned as a parent, stuff a smartphone in the child's pocket and send them to school that day. They'd see everything via Skype. And not long ago, I also purchased this. I have this very fancy, ugly watch on. It's my spy watch. It cost me $50. The spy watch records 20 minutes of video. It records audio for up to 2 hours. I'm recording today's lecture. My friend could simply go online and buy this now, put it on her kid, and ask her child to just start recording anything that the child found important. They could do this right now. And shrinking that down to a button and adding the other capabilities I'm talking about, that will all come with time. Because when this device hits the market, parents will find it irresistible because it finally gives them eyes in the back of their head. And now we need to ask ourselves, is this kind of thing good for either the parent or the child? Psychologist Sherry Turkle, hopefully you folks are familiar with Sherry Turkle, because she's done more work around children and technology than any other single human being. She's been doing research for 30 years on this. She believes, based on her own research, that this constant close connectivity between parent and child actually keeps the child from exploring their own boundaries because it artificially extends the helplessness of childhood by amplifying the child-parent bond. Connection has a consequence associated with it. To be connected is to be affected by that connection. So a small child might gain freedom with an electronic tether, but An adolescent might have a dependency on that connection which inhibits their normal development. Now, because all of this connectivity is such a recent thing, we don't have answers. Is this true or not? We don't understand what this looks like. But these are the kinds of questions that we now need to start to ask. And this connection has broad consequence for educators. I'm going to tell you a story that I heard 2 years ago here in Victoria. It's a high school classroom. Homework assignment was due. There was a child who hadn't turned in his homework assignment. It wasn't the first time this had happened, and so the teacher had a bit of a go at the student because their homework assignment was missing again. And as the teacher was having a bit of a go, the student reached into his knapsack, pulled out his mobile, punched a couple of numbers. When he got an answer, he said, "Yeah, you listen to the bitch," and held it up so that the teacher could talk. So connection and sharing completely rewire, they short circuit all of the relationships we've grown accustomed to inside of the classroom. How can a teacher maintain discipline when constantly being trumped by a child with a tether to a hyper-vigilant parent? And I'm sure some of you are already starting to get tastes of this. How can a child gain any independence when they're tethered like that? And how can any parent gain any sort of peace of mind while constantly monitoring the activities of their child? All of these dynamics are persistent features of the 21st century classroom. They're all already present. None of them are as yet pervasive. So we have some time right now to think about our response. Now, a few years ago, it's actually going back almost a decade, Stanford University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, that's my alma mater, made a revolutionary decision. They decided that they were going to publicly post all of their lesson plans, they were going to publicly post all of their homework assignments, all of the recordings of the lectures offered at their school. And at the time they did that, some people wondered aloud, why would I pay $40,000 a year for a college degree when I could get all of the content for nothing? Now you, as a room full of educators, understand that even to ask that question betrays a fundamental misunderstanding of what education is. In the 21st century, knowledge is freely available. We have no shortage of knowledge. But the mentoring that makes those knowledge resources useful and apprehensible, that mentoring continues to remain a precious resource. It's wonderful to have a lesson plan. It's essential to work with someone who has a deep understanding of the material. And that's the magic in education, that's the je ne sais quoi, that makes it a profoundly human experience. And it's one of the reasons why education has stubbornly resisted automation. Now, just last month, Stanford University announced that they were going to be teaching a course on artificial intelligence, and about two very well-known researchers to come step forward and teach the course. And it's going to be offered online, and anyone can freely come in and take it. Do you know how many people who have signed up to take the course? 115,000. All right. The instructors are like, yeah, we're going to have to figure out how this is going to work. They know that they're going to be doing the lectures, but they're going to need to get this 115,000 people to self-organize around study groups. How is that going to work online? Because there's scaling issues. Because a lot of teaching isn't just about putting up a lecture. It's about human interaction. Fortunately, if they manage to solve some of these problems, they will share those results with the rest of us and we'll understand. But this comes back to the point. We have no shortage of material. There's 4 million-ish English language articles on Wikipedia. There's over 2,500 videos on Khan Academy, and that was started by a fellow who's a researcher at MIT. There's tens of thousands of lessons on everything from cooking to knitting to gardening to renovation on YouTube. There's sites like Skillshare, which connect those who have specialist knowledge to those who want it. But even with that embarrassment of online riches, we are still yearning for the desire to connect, to breathe the same air as our mentors. And somehow, through some sort of very mystical process, and this is, it's been demonstrated time and again with studies, being in the same room with the teacher improves the child's ability to learn, even though the teacher really isn't doing anything. There's just something about the presence that unlocks that capacity. So, let me start off with asking, who is going to educate the educators? All of the materials that I've talked about so far are great for the students. They make the students' lives a lot easier, and in that sense, they've been profoundly populist. If they help an educator, that's all right. That's good. Accidental, but it's fine. because the connectivity has removed all of the difficulty of getting directly to students. It used to be the teachers were the ones who were directly connected to students. Well, they are now, and so is everyone else. And that means that in the back of a classroom, a student can tap away on a mobile and shout out corrections to a teacher's lecture. Oh no, I'm sorry, that's wrong, man. This is right. Why can't a teacher get a peer review of the same material? Why is that so hard? Theoretically, it should be easy. In practice, we're still waiting for it. Now, late last month, I had the good fortune to be a judge at something called Sydney's Startup Weekend. It's an event where technology entrepreneurs come up and do one-minute pitches of their technology ideas, and the best ideas get taken out, and they form into teams, and they spend 48 hours basically not sleeping and drinking a lot of caffeinated beverages, bringing them to life. And at the end, they show off what they've done. The winning project, this is a project called Classmate, it directly addresses the educator-to-educator, or my favorite new buzzword, E-to-E, connection. A little video about it.
Jane here is spending precious time creating a worksheet for her class tomorrow. But once the lesson is over, her worksheet gets filed away into a drawer. Jane isn't the only one. Educators all over Australia watch their hours disappear, creating worksheets that may have a similar content to Jane's. Enter Classmate. Classmate allows teachers to access educational resources like the one Jane made online. This means Jane spends less time creating documents, which gives her more time for the other areas of her teaching. Jane can also share the resources that she made, allowing other teachers around the world to access her work and use it in their own classrooms. Through Classmate, Jane may also choose to get paid for her resources. Classmate, a place for teachers to save and share their resources, letting teachers plan less and teach more.
Now that kind of sharing would give a teacher, every teacher, access to a pretty broad variety of lesson plans on a very wide set of topics. And as the national curriculum rolls out over the next couple of years, the subject areas that it defines within it as the separate nodes within the curriculum can act as a taxonomy, an organizing principle for the sharing of those lesson plans. So that you wouldn't have to search through thousands of individual lesson plans and just simply see a view based on keywords like Google. What you could do is you could do something more specific and focused. You could go to a specific node in the national curriculum and say, oh, here's all of the set of lesson plans that people want to share around that particular node. And that also means that it's very easy to find a particular lesson plan, which means that for any particular node, the best lesson plans would be very quickly identified, promoted, and shared around. And that would then mean that every teacher in Australia, possibly the world, should now or soon have access to the best class materials from the best teachers throughout Australia. And that means that teachers would be able to spend more time interacting with students and less time doing the hard slog of creating lesson plans. It wouldn't get rid of it completely, but it would share the task. But teachers are no different than their students. The best lesson plan in and of itself is insufficient. Teachers need to be able to have the opportunity to work with other teachers. They need to be mentored by other teachers. They need to conspire with other teachers in order to make their own pedagogical skills commensurate with the wealth of resources that are now opening up. So professional development has to go hand in hand with an accelerated sharing of knowledge, or else what's going to happen is that these sharing systems are only going to amplify the imbalances between classrooms and between schools. Now, Victoria has the Ultranet, and it's designed to facilitate the sharing of materials between teachers, students, and parents. And I'll let you in on a little secret, even though I am not a teacher, a student, or parent in Victoria, I have seen the Ultranet. I won't tell you where or how, because it was all very secret. I've seen the Ultranet. Folks, it's a lovely idea. The implementation, meh. It's difficult. It's difficult to use. And I think that for all of you, because you're all IT well-educated in IT, it doesn't present barriers, but I think for someone who is already perhaps not as IT capable as you, I think that they look at the alternate and I think they find it fundamentally confusing. Here's what I would recommend, that you aggressively engineer the alternate around a user experience that's appropriate to the three classes of individuals who are using it, teachers, students, and parents. Three different views. Start with the teachers and aggressively sit down and watch the teacher's workflow. Watch how you can make alternate easily match that. Educational sharing systems must be designed from the perspective of those who use them, those three different communities. They cannot be designed as a set of KPIs on a tick sheet. Now, one reason why I'm very interested in Classmate, and I'll disclose, I'm actually, once they won, I actually came up to them and said, I'd love to mentor you, pass on whatever experience I can. I have very high hopes for them because the lead person, the inventor of Classmate, is a third-year school teacher in New South Wales. So these are the problems that he's confronting every day, and he's trying to invent something to solve that problem. And sharing between educators and students creates a broader platform for sharing between students and educators. At present, almost all of that sharing happens inside of a classroom, and almost all of that sharing is immediately lost. We need to think about how to capture all of the sharing moments. We need to think about how to make those sharing moments available to students. I mean, you think about my nifty little device. It works very nicely for a child in kindergarten, but what about a student who's studying for a VCE? It gives them a record of all of the mentoring that they've received. And that could be shared broadly too, so that if you do a good job mentoring someone on a VCE, that student's going to upload it and other people are going to play with it. And so everything's going to be captured, everything's going to be everywhere, everything's going to be shared with everyone. And if this sounds a bit like living in a fishbowl, I can only say, please, please try to get used to it, because that's where we are now. Educators in particular are going to be hit hard by connectivity. Educators in IT are going to be hit doubly hard because you're in the middle of the connectivity. And it's going to happen because you're going to spend your days working with students who have never known anything but being connected. Students copy from one another, whether we like it or not. Teachers borrow from other teachers, that's a good thing. Administrators and departments imitate what they see working in other schools and in other states. It's how it's always been, but now that it's no longer difficult, it's happening incredibly quickly. It's accelerating widely, and it's transforming the idea of the classroom. So what I want to do now is turn to the curious case of David Cecil. David Cecil is a 25-year-old unemployed truckie from Cowra in New South Wales. He was arrested by the Australian Federal Police on the 27th of July on a series of charges that would see him imprisoned for a decade. Now, when he was unemployed and had nothing but time on his hands, and the internet at his fingertips, Cecil went onto the internet, found the thing that he found most interesting, he found the people who were most interested in it with him, and those people he connected to became his mentor, and he applied himself, he dedicated himself, spending up to 20 hours a day learning everything that he could learn from them. And so he went from a complete neophyte into expert class capability in just a few months. That's a feat of self-education that we could all admire in theory.